Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Culloden.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello everybody and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Culloden and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. So coming up on today's show, should we just accept that Ireland's corporation tax is good as it can be and just run with it? We debate. Also, we have news of continuing pub closures this week and we look at the economics of the pub trade and ask if maybe we just have too many pubs to begin with. Plus this.
Lehman Brothers is going bankrupt and financial markets from Asia to Europe are doing their utmost to prevent Monday from turning from dark to black.
Yes, the news of Lehman Brothers collapsing and the subsequent global financial crisis, we'll be looking at how the next global crash might look a little bit different and have a very different outcome. Now, you can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials on Instagram or LinkedIn or Blue Sky or X at Susan Hayes Culloden. Now, I have to say, it is a very exciting weekend in my life. It is great to see Cork back in Croke Park on All-Ireland final day, and I'm super excited to see what the outcome will be. So, just in case anybody might be unsure of where I'm coming from, I'm really excited about the outcome of this. Okay, so I want to start off by explaining to you the four stakeholders of the economy. So first up, we have consumers. That's you and me. We buy things and we provide our labour for a fee called a wage. Then we also have businesses who create products and services with a view to making a profit. We have governments who tax and spend. And then we have NGOs or non-governmental organisations who fill the gaps in the economy that businesses and government don't. So the next time that you hear about the latest report about GDP or any other metrics, remember that it's not just about what makes up an economy, but who makes up an economy, as it does take all four stakeholders to make it happen. And that includes you and me as a consumer today. Now, we all know the ways that Ireland's economy, despite being part of the EU, is fueled by its success in attracting foreign direct investment from the US. And with the threat of tariffs, there was a fear that this success was under threat. But my next guest has been crunching the numbers and thinks the Yankee dollar is still making its mark. So Thomas Hubert from The Currency, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Hi, Susan.
Now, you wrote a really interesting piece in The Currency. There was four key points in it, and I want to delve into each one of them. But I'm just going to start off with the first one by setting a piece of context. The payment of corporation tax to the Exchequer in 2011 was 3.5 billion euro, Thomas. And it looks like this year we're going to hurtle past 30 billion euro. So obviously that's a really big increase. And the first point you made in your piece is that the US Congress dropped the provision of retaliatory taxes on countries that were tough and multinationals, and Ireland was most exposed under this under-taxed profits rule. However, since that's been dropped, you said, since US multinationals will have nowhere to hide and mutual enforcement threats are unnecessary, so there's less of a disincentive to leave. So what I'm taking out of that is that rather than attracting companies back into the US, the US is now saying, stay where you are, you're okay. And particularly for Ireland, that's really good news. Is that assessment accurate?
As far as corporation tax is concerned, yes, in that the US is not really questioning the baseline policy that's been there for several decades, that if American companies want to go and conquer the world with American technology, especially, and we're talking really about exports, intellectual property being used to make IT and pharma products from the US dominate the world, then they can do a part of that business abroad and they will pay a lower rate of tax on that. And that hasn't changed because what was called the Big Beautiful Bill that was just passed by the US Congress did, it actually maintained incentives to do that were introduced by Trump in 2017. And the rule remains that when you pay, it used to be 12.5%, now it's 15% for multinationals. If you pay that rate of tax in Ireland and you bring the profits back to the US after that, there is no significant additional tax to pay, if at all, in the US. So that's really cemented by the latest US legislation. There was really a fear that that would go away, or there was also a fear, as you mentioned, that if there was some kind of top-up tax to reach that 15%, maybe because a company that has a base in Ireland wasn't paying enough tax elsewhere, then Ireland would be forced to tax them more to reach that 15%. And the US had threatened to have retaliation against that. And that was negotiated away from the US legislation. It's not in it at all. So all those base rules on where you pay tax, where are the profits, where is the intellectual property, they haven't changed. And a lot of that business has been going through Ireland. That part is not under threat.
Okay. In the piece, you mentioned a range of these regimes. Like, for example, as I had mentioned, you mentioned the under-tax profits rule. You also mentioned GILTI, the Global Intangible Low-Taxed Income, which has now changed its name. You also mentioned the Foreign-Derived Intangible Incomes regime. If we put all of this together, are you basically saying that Irish, that the multinationals in the US who have decided to take an office, headquarters, etc. in Ireland are now safe from these permanently?
Yeah, that's not changing exactly. And there was due to change. If there was no legislation in the US, it was due to expire and their tax would start rising at the end of this year if they stayed in Ireland. And that's no longer the case. So it's actually safer for them now than it was a month ago to stay in Ireland. That they're at threat from other things. We can talk about tariffs. Mm-hmm. We can talk about incentives that the US is trying to encourage American companies to build factories in America, but they're not changing the baseline in terms of what companies are already doing in Ireland.
Okay, let's bank that, as they say, as a very significant positive. And I want to move on to the next part in your piece, which is the report that was out from the IDA reporting a 37% year-on-year increase in the number of inward investment projects in the first half of this year to 179. So I went, after I read your piece, and I went to look at that report, and there was loads of great things in there. Like, there's 51 investments coming into Ireland for the first time. Over half of the commitments are into the regions, etc. But one line stood out to me, Thomas, and this is an Irish issue, of course, and that is, it said that apart from the challenges related to geopolitical uncertainty, and I'm quoting this, the priority areas for IDA Ireland are housing, energy, water, grid, transport, infrastructure, and the planning and regulatory system. Like, that's quite a list.
It is. And it's not only the IDA measuring that sentiment among multinationals. There was also the American Chamber of Commerce does a survey of its members. They are the big US multinationals present here in Ireland. And they said that, I mean, as recently as July this month, they say, what is your biggest threat, perceived threat to investment in Ireland? They say housing, far ahead of any other consideration, that their staff won't just have a place to live. And then next in line is infrastructure, along with tariffs. So it's like 30% are concerned about housing and 15% are concerned about tariffs and infrastructure at the same level. So I think if we are looking for threats to foreign direct investment in Ireland, I think we need to look for them at home. It's really the infrastructure, the ability to find people and put a roof over their head. That's where, and the skills that those people have, that's really what companies are worried about a lot more than taxes in other forms, whether it's corporation tax or tariffs.
And when I looked at where the companies are, like, they're talking about Astellas, they were talking about Squarespace, they were talking about a range of companies that are going to be right across the country. I mean, this issue is certainly countrywide. But if we move on and we look at the money that's in the bank. So every single tax revenue stream was up in the first half of the year, bringing in 47.4 billion, up 3 billion or 6.7% is what you quoted in the piece about the announcement of Pascal Donoghue and Peter Burke. Minister Pascal Donoghue and Minister Peter Burke at the time talking about when it comes to the tax take that's coming in. And that's, of course, great. And that money is in the bank. But I want to put some numbers to you, and that is 10 companies pay 1 in every 6 euro of that. Now, that's not 1 in every 6 euros of corporation tax. That's 1 in every 6 euro of tax. Also, corporation tax now pays for the equivalent of all education spending and the hospital system. And 3 companies, that's all, pay 38% of that. Now, I could keep going here, but there are several mentions in your piece of how volatile and vulnerable and precarious the corporation tax is. But what is your take, given the developments over the past month in the US?
So at the moment, for this year, corporation tax is going up. And the thing, as you said, is it's volatile, it's uncertain. We don't know what can happen year to year. If you think of it in terms of an investor, you know, you're always told when you're putting money in your pension or something like that, like, have a prudent mix. If you're okay to take risk because you're young or whatever, you have an appetite for risk, put it in equities in those companies that are in the stock market and goes up and down a lot. But in the end, you probably get more. If you want to be prudent, look at something else. And Ireland is nearly like an investor that is really going for risk. And so much of its tax revenue comes from those big companies, and whatever happens to them, up or down, it can affect the tax base a lot. So if you look at the figures so far this year, yes, they're up. And I mentioned June, which is when nearly the vast majority of companies pay a portion of their tax in the year, corporation tax. June was up. So that's a very good sign. And it means probably November will be up because the same company is paying again, and the overall year will be up again. So we're heading for another record this year. But if you look at the detail, say, for example, in May, the corporation tax take was down, and that's because Pfizer is very unusual in that it pays its corporation tax in May. And just one company like that, you're talking about the concentration in 3 or 10, the top big ones, how much they represent. Just one company like Pfizer having a rough patch at the moment, and it's evident from their quarterly filings in the stock market in the US. If you see the effect of that on the May corporation tax in Ireland, it was down. So that's how much impact one company can have. And I think much more than big policy changes, we see them being talked about, but not happening in the end. Maybe some of them will happen. But the bigger risk in terms of what comes year to year is if one or two big companies have a bad year, or several of them, that would be a very bad scenario. To think of companies like Apple, Microsoft, they're in that top three you're mentioning. And not only do they pay a lot of the corporation tax, their employees pay a lot of the income tax as well. So there would be a kind of a round of effects on how much money goes into the Irish state budget if any of those companies were in trouble at any point.
Can I ask you what you mean? And you said it a good bit ago, what you mean by the Irish government is pursuing a strategy of a lot of risk? Because one could also argue that the corporation tax is coming in, which is great. It's not like that we don't want it. We certainly do. But if it, like, what is it supposed to do? Because it is investing in Irish SMEs, let's say through Enterprise Ireland, the local enterprise office, Board BIA, etc. You can't just manufacture, and I like, I'm saying that tongue in cheek, you can't just manufacture big businesses indigenously who are going to be paying an awful lot of corporation tax. So isn't it doing the right thing by making sure that it's maintaining relationships as strong as they can and bringing in foreign direct investment as much as they can? So when you say that it's pursuing a strategy of a lot of risk, what do you mean?
I mean that this concentration is actually increasing over time. So those companies are getting so big that the share of tax they bring into the exchequer is getting bigger relative to the rest. So the risk they represent is actually increasing. And it's not to take that money. It's actually perfectly right and a very good thing for the country that those taxes are coming in. There are two things that you need to look at alongside that is what else do you have in terms of resources and how sustainable they are if this one suddenly stops? And also, what do you do with that money? And that's when we go into budget debates, because the state, like the current government, said they would be prudent with this, what they call the once-off taxes, and the fact that some of this corporation tax is not necessarily going to be repeated next year. But the problem is by the Department of Finance's own calculations, there is about 10 billion in the last year or two each year that was in that windfall that may not be repeated. But when it comes to what the state puts away in those funds for the mm-hmm. future, for infrastructure and for those bad times when we will need to keep investing when the money is not so good, that was only in the order of 6 billion. So it turns out a lot of that once-off money is actually being spent day to day, year after year. And that's where there's a very big risk.
Absolutely. And it's on that very note that we had Daniel Murray from the Business Post talking about that very point, and particularly the threat that the things that you mentioned at the beginning, like tariffs and so on, present in that way. I want to go back to Pfizer and the billion euro change in May. And the reason I want to do that is when I looked at your piece, you were talking about tax legislation and changes, particularly in the US. You were talking about the IDA, the attractiveness of FDI, etc. But the point when it comes to Pfizer's own profits and how they're respectively taxed, there's only so much that, of course, the Irish government or Ireland in general can influence. Like, volatility can come as a result of a change in business performance, a change in exchange rates, a range of other things besides that can quite literally influence how many beds we have in Irish hospitals and the facilities we have in schools in Ireland. How does the Irish government navigate that with prudence? Is it back to that point of how much is taken out of the Exchequer and put into the Sovereign Wealth Fund, or is there more that can be done?
That's one part. I think there's a very difficult political decision to be made every year in terms of not spending that money. Like, you can hear the clamor at the moment for cost of living supports and things like that that were once off 2-3 years ago and have become a regular feature of the budget. So maybe try to avoid promising things that become a kind of long-term promise because they are repeated. You need to be really clear that when something is once off, it's once off. When something is an investment, it's an investment that you make once and you're not going to repeat it, and not create expectations that money will be there all the time. I think that's the biggest challenge. It's more on the political side than on the technical financial side. Once you have, the clear messaging and acceptance in the electorate that some of that money is not permanent, then you need to, it's easier to put it aside or to invest it in long-term projects. But that's the first point that is very hard to get through, especially when the source of the money itself is being repeated year after year. Because we've mentioned Pfizer, it's not the first time that they're more of a cyclical company. They had a reduction in profit after COVID because their Pfizer COVID vaccines were so successful. Then that went down the next year, so did their corporation tax contribution to Ireland at the same time. But other companies were doing so well that it didn't really show on a full year basis. The corporation tax take has always gone up more of a decade now and more than that in the past. So there is this illusion that it will never go down, but at some point it will. So that's where the reality will bite, and the real test will be there for the government.
Well, that's why I referenced it at the beginning to say that it was only 3.5 billion that was paid into the Exchequer back in 2011. And of course, the main pivot point happened in 2015. But as I get to the end of reading your piece, here's where I'm at. From a tax law point of view, this is really good news for Ireland. From a foreign direct investment point of view, things are looking better than we thought. Where we are from a taxation receipts point of view, we've money in the bank that needs to be budgeted accordingly. We need to treat the corporation tax as corporation tax and not as firm or as sticky as income tax. And there's a lot outside of the government's control. And I didn't even get to ask you about pharma tariffs and a lot of other things. Is that really where we stand right now, Thomas?
It is. And I think one thing that is more important to discuss in terms of foreign direct investment is not the companies that are already here, but it's the next round of investment and mm-hmm. where they're going to go. And that's where the US tax plan and the legislation, the Big Beautiful Bill, have an impact because, for example, they're more aggressive now in giving tax breaks. If you build your factory in the US, you can amortize that investment quicker
and you did
your tax.
You
so that's all coming into play now.
You did indeed talk about bonus deductibility. So I definitely would recommend people to go and check out the piece in The Currency. Thomas Hubert, thanks so much indeed for joining me here on Taking Stock.
Thank you.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at the economics of Ireland's pub trade. Now, you're very welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, a report by the Drinks Industry Group of Ireland has highlighted that Ireland has lost more than 2,100 pubs since 2005, and that's 1 in 4, with rural areas hit the hardest. And today we're exploring what's behind those closures, what it means for communities, and what can be done to stem the tide. So we're joined now by economist Colin McCarthy and Michael O'Donovan, president of the Vintners Federation of Ireland. Colin and Michael, you're both very welcome to Taking Stock.
Hi.
Good morning.
Okay, so Colm, I'm going to start off with you. I'm just going to set the scene here. So the Irish drinks and hospitality industry employs 92,000 people in Ireland, and it buys 1.1 billion euro worth of Irish inputs. And the decline that I mentioned at the beginning is happening in every single county. What are the primary economic factors, do you think, driving the long-term decline in pub numbers across the country?
People are drinking less, period.
You think that's it?
I think that's mostly it. I was very surprised at the trope that characterised submissions by the Vintners Federation and the restaurants people when they were lobbying for a VAT reduction and so on. This idea that these problems in retail only arise in rural Ireland. That's just not true. There are far fewer pubs have gone on short hours and a few have closed in Dublin. But that's because there was a shortage of pubs in Dublin historically for reasons to do with restrictive licensing. And pubs in Dublin used to fetch enormous prices. They still fetch decent prices, but there are pubs closed in Dublin. And retail generally is facing difficult trading conditions in all sorts of areas. There are rural post offices have closed. Maybe there's still too many of them. There's a lot of banks have closed. And you get this happens. You get this over long periods of time where there is a redistribution in the composition of aggregate demand. And it's caused by all sorts of different factors. In Ireland, every time some business or industry faces a bit of a downturn for whatever reason, the instant reaction is to say the government should give us a tax break.
Okay, well, let's put this to Michael. The very first thing the column said there is that people are drinking less, and studies show that people are indeed drinking about a third less since, well, roundabout would say 20 years, give or take, in between 2000 and 2005. Do you think, Michael, or do you agree, is that all that's driving this trend, or have you noticed any other changes in consumer habits?
No, look, we have seen, obviously, there's been reports out recently that have shown consumption of alcohol in this country has fallen dramatically, and we have seen, young people especially, they're, you know, more going to the gym and, you know, we're in competition with streaming services. So it has been an issue over the last number of years for publicans, you know, for people going out far less than what they used to before. And when they do go out, it's generally, you know, one night that they go out as before, you know, people be going out two or three nights. So that has been an issue. Footfall through the door has been a big issue the last number of years for our trade. But I think, you know, that combined with the cost base that we have, it's been a perfect storm the last 10 years, really. And that's why you've seen so many closures over that period.
Okay, so Colm, it is, yes, people are drinking less, and also it's an increase in the cost. But we're dealing with a rising population, and yet, yeah, the author of the report, Professor Anthony Foley, said in the absence of government intervention, we're likely to see a further 600 to 1,000 clubs close over the coming decade. And you said there's a change in aggregate demand, and I don't think anybody could argue with that. Do you see that trend continuing then?
It's difficult to know. There's been a squeeze on retail, which is not uniform across the country. Of course, there are individual rural towns and villages that used to have half a dozen pubs. I used to be amazed at the numbers years ago, and some of them have closed. But these things happen. In the city, there's something going on in Dublin which I find curious. There's a few pubs have closed, but not a handful, really. But a lot of them don't open now on Monday night, or they open and close fairly early. And some of them are complaining. I know a few people who run pubs not far from where I live, and they complain that it's hard to get people to work two shifts.
I'd imagine so.
You know, I mean, there is, and you do have to, you know, if you open early for breakfast or whatever, you can't really run on until midnight without two shifts. It's ridiculous to expect people to work that. And it's hard to get staff. There is, you know, there's nearly full employment. That's a factor. Plus, one pub I know well used to have a terrific lunch trade. Not far from here, a mile or two from where we're sitting. They used to have very good lunch trade. People are not going into the office, or they're going into the office a couple of days a week. Lunch trade is gone.
But are they going for lunch elsewhere, though? If they're working from home, are they popping out there? Or do you think working from home is decreasing a lot of that from happening?
I don't know what they're eating. They might be growing rhubarb in the garden, for all I know. But what they're not doing is crowding the central area pubs at lunchtime, and they used to. Now, there's still pubs that have a good lunch trade. But my main point is the following. there will be, over long periods of time, spells of boom and spells of contraction in various different businesses and industries. And we're into a kind of a phase, especially the last few years, where everybody immediately turns to central government and says, what are you going to do about this? And central government needs to get into the habit of saying, look, business is business. And sometimes things turn down and you have to adjust as best you can.
So, Michael, business is business. Is that the way you would take it?
No, not really. You know, like over the last four budgets, the government have inflicted 36% wage increase on us, you know, and we have sick day requirements, you know, like say our industry is a forward facing industry. So it happened to me last week, one of my staff members was sick. I had a party and on the Sunday night, I had to ring another staff member to come in. So like that was a double cost on me because I had to pay my employee that was sick, which look, that's the law, that's what you have to do. But I had to go and get another employee to come. So I was paying a double wage for that night, you could say. So that hit the bottom line, you know, for our industry when it's a small, low margin industry. And that's, you know, government policy that has put that cost on us. And, you know, like we've had other government costs that are really making it really difficult for us to trade out of at the moment.
Well, I saw one thing, Michael, before I go to Colm again, that in the press release, it says the government could improve commercial viability overnight by cutting excise by 10%. And when I read that figure, I thought, okay, given the rise in operational costs, such as wages like you've mentioned and energy and VAT, would it really be the case? Would that change viability completely if excise was to be cut by 10%?
Well, yeah, well, from the Vintners Federation viewpoint, we're asking for excise a rebate on our draft products. We're asking for that to be done because that would really target the pub industry and help the pub industry. And like excise is a within the gifted government and we have the second highest excise duty in Europe. But yes, we're back to European averages for consumption now. So the aim was a number of years ago to try and reduce our consumption. We're there. At the European average. So, you know, we'd be asking the government to help us with that because that would be a targeted support and would help our pub industry. And, you know, tourists come here to Ireland to go to an Irish pub, an authentic Irish pub, especially rural Irish pubs. And if the rural pub disappears, you know, it will have a knock-on effect on our tourist industry going forward.
Well, there you go, Colm. I mean, there's been two factors affecting pubs. One is the fact that the government has been, discouraging consumption. And the second thing is increase. Indeed, as you say, that's not uniform, but two increases there. It's pretty reasonable then, isn't it, to come from where Michael's coming from and calling for an intervention from government?
Yeah, but every single business group and trade association in Ireland, and they have a representative function and they have to pitch for the best deal they can get for their members. But they all look to central government all the time.
Where would you look?
Do you believe that the government can solve all problems instantly by cutting taxes?
Well, I mean, in a way, that's the question that I put to him, but I put it back to you. If it is the case that an organisation like this, in a sector like this, aren't going to turn to government for help, where should they go?
Hold on a second now. The notion that central government, either directly through the tax system or through some of its agencies, is operating a first aid service for any and all sectors of business is ridiculous. And if the government has a significant excise duty on booze, which it does, and there have been increases in recent years, that revenue accrues to government. It doesn't get incinerated. Right now, the government is trying to figure out what are they going to do in the budget in October. If they were to cut excise duty on drink, then people would instantly turn around and say, well, what about excise duty on cigarettes? And what about VAT? VAT has not been increased since 2011, I think. The top rate has been 23%. But they did decide to cut the VAT on restaurants, and it looks as if that will be included in the budget. And it had been 13.5%. It's now going to be 9%. So that means that instead of paying 200 quid for a meal for four, which you will easily do in posh restaurants, you'll get a tenner back or whatever. as if that's going to make a difference. Government cannot go around and narrow the tax base any further. The last several budgets have been riddled with let-offs for this, that and the other group and tax giveaways. The government is well over its self-imposed or self-declared target on current expenditure control. There are extraordinary demands in for more public spending on everything you can capital spending,
and so,
on everything you can think of.
And so I'd like to go to Michael then. I think it would be interesting to hear from your perspective, Michael, what has business done? Like, what are the range of things that you've done in order to mitigate whether it's the cost base, increase the footfall, etc.? What has been the efforts of the industry broadly? Because I'm sure there have been many.
Yeah, look, the industry has invested hugely, you know, since COVID into our industry because everybody saw changes in that time. And, you know, everybody's put their back to the wheel because if we didn't, we wouldn't have survived the last number of years. But we're now in a scenario where, you know, government policy has been has changed over that period of time. And the cost base that we have now is just gone too high. And that's why, you know, businesses will not survive. And, you know, there's over 40,000 people employed directly in pubs across the country. And, you know, that's if we do lose more pubs, that will be more people, you know, losing their jobs. And in rural Ireland, you know, especially where there's no post office left, no shop left, the pub is the only community hub left. That's where people get part-time jobs. It's where people get their first jobs. And if they go, you know, that puts more pressure on families and further disposable income, you know, for mommy and daddy. If there's a college student going off to college, it's less money for them. So, you know, pubs play a cultural part in our heritage and our society. So do we want that to disappear over time? So without help, they will disappear. And that's why we're appealing to the government. We're in a state now where we do need some help because they're just not viable to keep running them at the moment. And, you know, there's no, you look around at the moment, the amount of pubs that are for sale, because there's no next generation taking on the pub, you know, when mommy and daddy are retiring. And so, like, it's part of our cultural heritage in rural Ireland that will disappear if we don't help it.
So, Colm, there's a real social element, obviously, and a community element to the pub, as well as the hospitality function in its own right. And the press release, going back to the study that we're here to talk about, it talks about the impact of trade tariffs and reduced inbound tourism. Do you see any positive economic impacts that can help the rural Irish pub, or the pub in general?
Having fewer of them is a good start. If there's a town somewhere that used to have six pubs and two of them have packed it in, there's now four, then presumably the four remaining are more viable than they were. And if we're faced with a situation where, first of all, the overall level of alcohol consumption is down, that's a choice the public have made, and it's clear that the off-trade, off-licences and so on, people are drinking at home and so on, and people are staying at home more than they were, including people who are working from home. If that's the case, then the industry has to do the adjusting. And the industry has made the adjustment. There are fewer pubs. These things happen. It's not clear to me that every time there is a trend of this type, in this case a negative one, for a particular branch of the retail industry, that the government should dive in and say, we will make whatever changes to taxes and so on are necessary in order to retrieve the situation that was there several years ago when demand was different.
Well, it's been fascinating speaking to you both, and obviously coming from two very different perspectives along the way as well. Thank you so much indeed to economist Colm McCarthy and Michael O'Donovan, President of the Vintners Federation of Ireland, for your time today.
Thank you.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we take a look at what the next financial crisis might look like and ask if we're looking in all the wrong places. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. And I just want to tell you about something that I'm working on at the moment. I'm working with a range of interns on a 2-week internship, and I asked them to listen back to the show since it began and to pick out what topics they felt were most of interest to their generation since Taking Stock with Me began 13 weeks ago. And their top five that they told me were Ozempic, food security, inflation, the economics of pets, and what makes a great CEO. And as listeners may have become accustomed to at the moment, I'm always interested in market research. So I just thought that I'd share that with you today, that that is what my representatives of that particular age group have been reflecting with me. And of course, as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. So please do email us in takingstock@newstalk.com. So cast your mind back to 2007 or whenever you heard the phrase subprime market. Did you take much notice, or was it until the fitful months of autumn 2008 that subprime got cemented in our minds as a cause of the crash? So the question that we asked today on Taking Stock is something similar emerging in front of us, but with a different name. And perhaps we need to look at climate change from the perspective of being the catalyst of a major financial shock. So I'm delighted to tell you that Polita Clark from the Financial Times has written a brilliant piece on this very subject, and we have her here on Taking Stock today. Polita, you're very welcome back.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Susan.
Okay, I'm going to summarise the piece briefly. It's a really meaty, strong article, Polita, and here's what I understood your thesis to be. If, due to climate change, properties become uninsurable, the asset value would fall. This could lead to mortgage default, and some areas could become unmortgageable, thus unbanked, and leading to a significant financial crisis. So I went and I had a look at my own research around this area. And just to see the trend here, and insurers paid out a record £558 million for weather-related damages to homes and possessions in Britain in 2004. And this was £127 million higher than weather-related claims payouts for the year before. So where do we stand and where are we going on this, Polita?
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, I think you're seeing similar trends in many countries around the world, particularly in the US, world's largest economy, enormous property market. And there we are seeing that as a result, in large part, not entirely, but in large part, in states where there has been these really quite extreme disasters, like whether it's wildfires in California or hurricanes in Florida, that insurers are under more and more pressure. And so they are really starting to withdraw in the way you just described. And that is, some analysts think that that is going to lead to, in the words of one Senate Budget Committee report that came out at the end of last year, it is going to lead to a situation where we're going to see a meltdown of potentially similar proportions to that in 2007, 2008, or at least something that could approach that. Now, not everybody agrees with that, I have to say. And a lot of people think that even though there could be a sort of a slow motion version of the 2008 financial crisis, it will in some ways be even worse because, although it may not be as abrupt, it'll be permanent because the underlying cause is not financial, and so you won't see a sort of financial recovery in the way that we have had in the past. The underlying cause will be physical, i.e. it'll be because of this ever more extreme weather, which is fueled by climate change, which, as we speak, is showing no signs of dissipating.
Okay, so I want to get to the potential recovery, like you say, or the lack of it. I do certainly want to delve into that, but when I was reading your piece, I was thinking about how the financial crisis was, by virtue of the name, sectoral. But you have a real geographical approach to this. And in the Bank of England stress test that they conducted a couple of years ago into exactly what you're talking about, it found that if no additional action was taken, general insurers projected 50 to 70% higher average annual losses from flooding and windstorms by 2050. And 7% of households might be left without insurance coverage due to risk-based premium increases. But particularly, 10% of UK postcodes account for 2/3 projected increases in those losses. So this mightn't just be a sectoral specific issue. There are entire regions within the UK, and there's other parts as well. There's other countries we'll talk about. This could wipe out a huge amount of economic value in whole regions.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And you know, the Bank of England, the UK, it's not the only place where these sorts of assessments and analysis are being done. And they have, central banks in particular, in the last 10 years or so, have been increasingly putting out these reports, doing this sort of analysis, coming up with scenarios that, as you say, are showing what could potentially happen. I have to say that in large part, it's not that they're being ignored. It's just that institutions, I think, find it difficult until they're under real pressure to really do much about it. And, you know, it is absolutely true that I think those sort of analysis that you just referenced there, which again has been found in places like the Netherlands and other areas around the world, where you can see that it wouldn't take much to really have quite a large financial impact. Climate change could have quite a large financial impact. And in fact, you know, central banks themselves have found that if you fast forward to, well, it's not very fast, but if you look at 2050, by some analysis, they are suggesting that you could see a drop-off of something around 15% in global GDP as a result of climate change. So they're really quite large figures that they come up with. But, you know, they're just not seen as being definite. It's seen as a risk in the future, and there are so many risks that institutions have to cope with in the here and now that I think it's, you know, they kind of struggle with incorporating this sort of risk into their planning.
I also think as well, one of the things that poses a challenge in the conversation about this is this sense of that it's all over. So what's the point in trying to do something now when we're in that particular case? But we can't look at it like that at the same time. And I think the angle you took in the piece is this isn't just about emissions and various other different points. This is about, can you get insurance for your house? And if you can't, what happens to the value of it? And then what is the knock-on effect of that on a macro level? But I do want to come back to the point that you brought up earlier about a bailout, because fundamentally how we got out of the 2008 crisis was the government needed to row in, bail out certain banks. Then, of course, there was really, really significant economic pain, but a recovery followed. And you drew a parallel between this and the climate change crisis, which is there is no bailout necessarily that can be put in place. And I looked at the European Environmental Agency that said most countries reported that over 50% of their climate and weather-related event losses were uninsured. And so the insurance protection gap has widened over time as total economic losses have grown faster than insured losses. So therefore, I ask you, Polita, what is the government's role in this as it unfolds? Apart from prevention, we know about that. We know they're working towards that of varying success. But what would a recovery or a bailout look like then, if any?
Well, yeah, I know. I mean, it's a really, really important question. So number one, you know, if we don't cut emissions, if we don't get on top of emissions, then all we can expect to see are just more and more climate extremes, you know, hotter and hotter weather leading to more and more disasters. I think that's pretty clear. So number one, emissions do have to be tackled. But in the meantime, you know, experts around the world, and particularly in the US and in Europe, have been saying, look, you know, a lot could be done when it comes to rules for building a house or insuring a house. And it's just not being done in many places because, again, you know, people haven't seen it as a real priority. So, for example, here in the UK, you could stop people from building in floodplains. You could just potentially outlaw a whole lot of construction in areas where people know that you know, either the coast is going to fall into the sea or there's going to be sort of massive river-related flooding or any sort of flash flooding. Or there's lots of things that could be done to regulate where people are able to build. But politicians find it really difficult to do that. Likewise, when it comes to building new houses, you could say, well, look, if you're going to build here, you just have to make sure that the building is able to withstand temperatures of this amount, fires of this level of severity, and all other sort of manner of things could be done to the actual building stock to make sure that it's more resilient. Again, though, this costs money. The construction industry obviously often doesn't like it. Homeowners often don't like it. But, you know, really, I think countries are going, or authorities are going to have to really grab the nettle here and take a lot harder look at how we make sure that insurance still remains viable. Because although people think insurance is just this incredibly kind of dull, grey, not very interesting sector, really the whole financial system rests on it.
Yes, because if the insurance can't pay out, well, then the insurance itself and the viability of it threatens so many other elements besides. But what I want to ask you about, though, is the assumptions that underpin the insurance and whether we need to look at the insurance sector or the actuaries underpinning it, because there's a lot of projections in this space. And one of the challenges in this conversation, again, Polita, is how long away these things seem. Like you said there, if we fast forward into 2050 before you stopped and said, well, it's not that far away, but it feels it. And when I looked at the Bank of England's report about this, they posit that loss projections might be four times higher than some insurers' own estimates for worst case scenarios. So is it that the modelling has been done incorrectly? Is it that the environment, literally, has changed more than we think? Is it that there are variables in the equation that haven't been factored in? Like, how could these estimates be so wrong?
The central banks that have been putting out a lot of these estimates have been coming under fire from some analysts and some campaigners and indeed even some actuary groups, because it is felt that they have not taken into account physical risks, climate tipping points, these really sort of sweeping moments when the climate systems can really change in a massive and irreversible way. And the central bankers that I've spoken to say, well, yes, you know, that kind of is true, because to a large extent it's really difficult to model things like tipping points. So we haven't felt as though the science has been robust and enough for us to say definitively what it's going to mean if we see these sorts of changes in the climate system. But interestingly, what they do say is that more recently, in the last few years, there have been changes in climate that were not predicted, were not expected. And so I think what woke people up specifically, and certainly I would say what woke me up, because I've been covering environmental issues for a long time and I've heard a lot of warnings about the sort of effects that climate change might have on financial instability. I haven't really thought about them as much as I did towards the end of last year when we had those flash floods in Valencia in Spain, and then these extraordinarily close together and huge hurricanes in Florida, followed by those amazingly destructive fires in California. Now, all of these places have seen natural disasters of this ilk before, but they haven't seen them at the scale and at the level of destruction that we saw in the last sort of year or so. And so I think that's really woken people up to the fact that, you know, something's happening in the climate system which we weren't really expecting to see physically as soon as we now are. And scientists themselves have been saying for some time, look, temperatures, global temperatures are going up in a way that we weren't kind of expecting. We weren't expecting to see 12 months in a row of average temperatures being 1.5 degrees higher than pre-industrial time. So, you know, something is changing out there and it is waking people up, I think.
Well, two things on that. One is you mentioned about the climate tipping point, and there's that real emotive phrase that you have in the piece where it says, it's like modelling that the Titanic will hit an iceberg, but not that the ship will sink. And I think that's such a hard idea to imagine when it comes to understanding exactly when it comes to modelling and numbers that can seem quite intangible. But the other thing is when you talk about the flash floods in Valencia, etc., I think that often when that conversation comes up, it can sometimes be dismissed as, ah yeah, but sure, that's a once off or whatever. That's why I went back to the trend at the beginning. When you look at things in aggregate, when you look at the overall trend, and the last thing I want to ask you about, you're very, very careful and diplomatic, but political, in your piece, Polita, when you distinguish between, when you're getting your sources in the US, between Democrat and Republican. Where do you see the current positions of both parties going in the months to come?
Oh, well, I mean, when you look at the US and what's happening under the Trump administration, they are very deliberately trying to not just slow the energy transition, but really put it into reverse and prolong the life of fossil fuels. And I'm afraid that what that is likely to mean is that we just see a continuation of these climate trends and a growth in the risks that climate change poses for financial stability. And I think that that's a problem. And it worries me that other countries are going to potentially, if not, not, I don't think they'll follow the Trump administration's lead, but I think in many cases they will take their feet off the accelerator pedal and not perhaps push as fast as we clearly need to go when it comes to cutting carbon emissions.
Polita, we're going to have to stop it there, but you know, as I listen to everything that you're saying, everything has such merit in what you're saying, but we have to look at this from a perspective of positivity as well and say that there has to be opportunities out there for people, for businesses, for governments, for to really turn this around. So thank you so much indeed, not just for joining me today, but for conducting excellent research and producing an excellent piece in the Financial Times. Thanks so much, Polita Clark, columnist with the Financial Times, with me here today.
Thanks so much, Susan.
Well, that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. Next week on the show, we'll be getting the views of a former US comptroller on the state of global trade. And I'll just remind you that this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. I look forward to chatting to you next week.